Welcome to the Stabbin' Stylists Podcast. I'm Randa.
And I'm Ashley.
We are just two stylists who love true crime and hair, and we're going to tell you about both.
This is a true crime podcast. These stories may be disturbing to some. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, y'all.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen.
So we're sitting here trying to decide what our hair effect's gonna be. So mousse is a two-part product, which is why you have to shake up the can and dispense it that way. And then when you get it in your hands, you're actually supposed to emulsify it in your hand and take it back to liquid before you apply it. It's like a conditioner and a gel and together. So yeah, when you squeeze mousse in your hand, say you have medium long hair, then I would say you need about like the size of an orange in your hand. Get you a good mousse and let it sit for a second, and then just start rubbing your hands together gently until that goes back down to more of a liquid consistency, and then apply it in your hair and you'll get better results. Especially for you curly girlies.
Because then you're actually getting the full effect of right. the product.
Versus like a foam, not to be confused with a foam. A foam you want right. to stay foamy.
Fine hair that doesn't hold curl really well, try putting a mousse in your hair before dry it, and it will give it a little bit of a hold.
Yes. So you have any kind of like a shag or like a mullet haircut, mousse is your friend.
Mousse, people think mousse is just for curly girlies, and it's not. For multiple different reasons.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you can also put mousse on dry.
I didn't know that.
You sure can. Especially if your client, say it's an updo, or like they're trying to get a lot of hold, but their hair is like finer.
Yeah.
You put on a little bit of mousse dry, brush it through real good till it's dried down on the hair and it's all dispersed and it's not like crunchy or right. anything. And then curl the hair. Boy, it ain't going nowhere.
Trigger warning, this episode contains graphic crime.
I'm not completely sure what we're even going to title this one yet. I've been saying Chattanooga Club Murders, but this takes some turns. So buckle on in. So actually, I have to give Yuri a shout out on this one. Yuri got me this book, and he was so excited to give me this book that he told me what the case is before, so I had told Randa, and I'm really excited to get into this one. This one has a lot of local landmarks in it, and it's set in Chattanooga, and there's abandoned properties in this one, there's murder, there's corruption, there's everything. So let's get into it, shall we?
Let's go.
All right. The book that I read was Murder by the River by Jerry Burden, and I got a lot of information from his book. The rest of it came from articles, old articles, stuff like that. I had to kind of reformat the information he gave to make it make sense in a linear line for this podcast. Yeah. So if you want to
love a good timeline, you know that.
Yes. So if you want to do a super, super deep dive into the story, check out this book. And I'm pretty sure this book just came out.
Oh, okay.
Just came out. And the author lives in Atlanta.
Okay.
So he lives somewhere near here.
Locale.
Yes. But it is amazing the research he did on this. And this is just a fascinating story.
Hit me.
So first, we're going to start in the 1950s in Chattanooga.
Oh, we're going way back.
There was a bootlegger. And the bootlegger's name was Katie Holcomb. Katie had a daughter named Christine. Christine married a man named Arthur Hull. And they had a son named Billy Hull. Now, Katie was known for being rich off that tax-free liquor money. What she would do is she would not make the moonshine. She would get the moonshine.
Okay.
From like different distillers around the area. And she would bring it back to her property. And she would fill 50-gallon oak barrels. And she would bury them in her backyard for a year or
so
more.
So she's aging it for her.
Yes. So she would age it before she sold it.
Okay.
So Katie would fill these big barrels and bury them in the backyard. Obviously, you need a little bit of muscle to do that. So she would get her son-in-law, Arthur, and her grandson, Billy, to come help her. Billy grew up in Rossville, Georgia, which is just south of Chattanooga. Yep. In 1951, Billy married his high school sweetheart, Gloria Jean Hayes. They were actually still in high school at the time. Billy had a sister named Gloria Hull. So the wife went by Gloria Jean so that they wouldn't get confused. After graduation, Billy attended Tennessee Tech in Cokeville on a football scholarship, and they did the long distance thing for a little bit, but then Gloria Jean ended up moving up to Cokeville and stayed with him through graduation. Then they moved back to Rossville, and in 1958, she gave birth to their son, Billy Jr. And in 1962, had her son, Timothy. It was around this time that the nightclub scene was starting to pop up in Chattanooga. It's the late 60s, so go-go clubs are popping up, and there was one in Chattanooga. Billy starts working at a bouncer at the nightclub. In the book, they say that whenever, like, some shenanigans, some chaos would break out, the crowd would start chanting, Billy Hull, Billy Hull. And they said you wouldn't even see Billy coming, but you would feel Billy's presence coming. So Billy Hull was the dude back then.
Like, you didn't mess with Billy.
No. The Go-Go Club was owned by Paul Gray. And he's actually Paul Gray Jr. And he was born in Chattanooga in 1933. Now, Paul's father was also named Paul, but in this next sentence is really the only time that I refer to him. So anytime I say Paul Gray, it always means Jr. His dad owned a franchise of the Yellow Cab Company in Chattanooga. And in 1956, dad died and Paul took over. Around the same time, he started dabbling in real estate and he was purchasing apartments and duplexes. And he saw the need for a go-go club in Chattanooga.
He saw the need.
So he opened one, and he actually called it the Go-Go Club. It was off Macaulay Avenue, and that's actually the club where Billy ends up becoming a bouncer. So Paul decides that he needs more than just the Go-Go Club. So he's like, all right, he's going to open this elegant Las Vegas-style restaurant and entertainment club and call it PJ's Supper Club on Lee Highway. PJ's actually was given the first liquor by the drink license in Chattanooga on January 1st, 1973. So there were two other clubs up on the mountain, on Lookout Mountain. Okay. And it was the Panorama Club and the Fairyland Club. I mentioned these to my mother-in-law yesterday. She said my mother-in-law said it was like super like exclusive dinner club.
Ooh.
You have to think this is Lookout Mountain and there's a lot of money on Lookout Mountain. So those type of businesses make sense.
Right.
He opened PJ's on Lee Highway. So it's not the same area. There's not the same dynamic there. These are middle class families. So it didn't do the same as the ones on Lookout Mountain did. And PJ's shut after just a few years. PJ's wasn't open very long. But around the time that he was opening PJ's, he also realized that there needed to be something for the younger crowd. He decided to make the Playmate Club because this is at the same time, you know, it's in the 60s, Playboy and the problematic Hugh Hefner was in full swing. And the Playmate Club actually had two sides to it. One side had rock music and the other side had country music.
Ooh.
And after a few years, the attorneys from Playboy actually contacted him and was like, hey, you can't use this name.
He actually was getting like copyrighted, basically.
And he actually kind of laughed it off and was just kind of like, ha 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 ha.
But they like sent him like a cease and desist.
Yes. And so he changed the name to the Play Late Club. So I'll probably slip up and still call it the Playmate Club. But from this time forward, it's like the Play Late Club. And it was actually a huge success all the way up until the mid 80s. Like it was open for a while. And he had the Chattanooga police in his pocket. They would just turn a blind eye to shenanigans there. I tried Googling some of these clubs, but really all you can find is like the stories connected to like these cases.
Yeah.
And there's no pictures of them. Like you can't find any pictures of the inside, but God, I would die.
Yeah, they probably didn't want pictures the inside.
And you got to think too, not everybody had a phone. So like they had to carry like a camera.
There was no like Google photos cache of like reviews of a place with photos.
But when he opened the Playlight Club, Paul asked Billy to start managing the Go-Go Club. And Billy was like, okay, this is not that hard. Like, I can do this for myself. So in 1969, he found a space and he decided to open a club of his own. And it was in like a super prime location near the corner of Brainerd Road and Germantown Road, which I actually read later becomes Lee Highway. But this is where it seems like the shadiness probably already starts. The property was purchased from a man named James Bookie Turner. He was the county sheriff and later the fire and police commissioner in Chattanooga. Just 2 years before the purchase, Turner had been indicted for selling illegal liquor and taking protection payoff from moonshine runners. He was acquitted, but you have to think, Billy's grandmother was a bootlegger.
Yeah.
So I'm sure this is probably not the first type of business he's had with him. However, the man was acquitted, innocent until proven guilty. He was not proven guilty, so who knows?
Who knows?
But Billy named this new club the Lion's Den. Because around this time, him and Gloria Jean lived in a lake house on Possum Creek in Chattanooga. And Paul was actually their neighbor here. And it was said that they kept a lion in a cage at this house.
What?
What is more 60s than hearing about somebody keeping a lion in their cage?
Oh, we got Tiger King over here.
The name of the club was the Lion's Den, so they assumed that's where it came from, was he obviously had a thing with lions. But during this time, Billy actually also had financial interest in a couple health clubs, so that's what was...
Health club like gyms?
I think so, and back then, I think like med spas that were like gyms, but that's what was paying his bills, so that gave him money to be able to... kind of do other things with it. By 1970, he purchased the property next door to the Lion's Den, which was the Brainerd Theater. And it was a movie theater that hadn't been closed down for that long. He did tons of renovations. You have to think the floor of the movie theater was sloped down to where the screen is.
Right.
He built a big dance floor down there. And the bar, when they came in, he was like, how long's the bar? And they said 18 feet. And he said, make it 24, because he wanted the longest bar in the South. It was Polynesian and African decor with 20-foot tall cages in it. And in between, there was, when you walk in, there was a rotunda and there was a little cashier, essentially, that would take your cover money for the Castaways Club. That's what the new area was called. And then on the other side is the Lion's Den. And on the Lion's Den side, there's pinball and pool tables and stuff like that.
Yeah, so more the lounge on the Lion's Den side.
Right, and then like a club on the other side. And then like a
dance club on the other side.
Exactly. And they would have off-duty police officers from Chattanooga Police Department that would work their security right there at the little vestibule area where the cashier is.
And they get to make a little extra money on the side or whatever.
And so this place was supposed to be absolutely grand. Like when you're walking into the Lion's Den, there was like a big stone arch and there was a polar bear, which doesn't really fit the African decor.
Yeah, but that's what I'm like. You just, all of the things that said 70s opulence.
Yeah, I mean, basically.
That was 70s opulence.
They were like, that looks fancy and expensive.
That's fancy as fuck. It's going in
there. Oh, wait till we get to the house. It's even better, which is where we're going next. So 1970, he's a super busy guy, right? And he purchased a plot of land on the Missionary Ridge area, which was like the up and coming like rich area at the time. And he started construction of his 5,600 square foot, 4.5 bathroom dream palace. It took them 14 months to complete it, and it was done by February of 1972. As you enter the home, you are greeted by 2 7-foot-tall tiki heads with torches attached to each side of the
front door. I know there was gas-powered, too, so they could turn them on.
I'm sure. Over the doorway, there was, like, faux bamboo with a thatched roof look.
Yeah, there was, with palm fronds.
And you could drive under it, and it was like a carport to shield you from the weather. Yeah. When you walked in, there was a huge swimming pool complete with a tiled Playboy Bunny logo, and there was a 30-foot vaulted ceiling over the pool that was covered by a plexiglass skylight and a crystal chandelier hanging from the middle. The pool room was climate controlled and it had tropical plants growing inside. It also had a fireplace, a bar, and a seating area. In the pool, there was a waterfall and a diving board over the 12-foot deep end of the pool. A 12-foot indoor pool.
Indoor pool.
In their living
room. In a house.
On the other end of the pool, there were 2 tiled swim tunnels that simulated the ears of the bunny that allowed you to swim into 2 bedrooms. And then there was like large glass walls that separated the bedrooms from the pool rooms, like above where the tunnel is. And in the back of the house, it seemed like a more normal living area with red shag carpet. There's a marble top bar, mirrored walls, and double doors that lead out to this awesome patio area that has a 12-person hot tub, a large copper island bar, and a sauna. And actually, in the book, they mention, like, how pretty, though, at night, looking over. Because, I mean, you gotta think you would be on top of Chattanooga. The helicopter pad had Mickey Mouse on it.
Yes.
But it's never, they say, it's never confirmed if a helicopter ever actually landed on the pad. And then their master bedroom was, like, pink and gold and floral wallpaper. And they say every hallway and bathroom in this house is like floor to ceiling, just marble. It was called a lot of things. It was called the Tiki Palace, the Tiki Mansion, Billy's Tiki Mansion. Soon after they completed the house, they had an open house and 10,000 people attended. And they were in Electricity Building magazine because the fact that they had like all these amenities in this house were just crazy at the time.
Who else has a house like this? This is some shit you hear about like Hollywood stars having.
Right. There was parties there. There was a photo shoot from the high school that they had there. But there are no pictures of them living inside of the house other than the ones that are in the magazine. The magazine kept, and you can like Google those and find them. There's two. There's one where they're like Glory Jean and Billy are both standing like above the pool, and then there's just one more of the outside, but there's no pictures of it when they lived there. But later in the story, we will get on to, you can find dozens of pictures of this house online now because it was abandoned for years.
Yeah.
But just months after they finished the house, Billy filed for a divorce. He said that it was because of adultery and cruel and inhumane punishment. But it was rumored that they had both had affairs. Exactly 2 months later, the divorce was finalized. So, the next story, we are going to track a little bit off of Billy's life. And I'm going to tell you a story about a fire and a robbery that it's going to seem out of place right now, but will come back to play later in the story. So on March 31st, 1973, at 8:45 in the morning, a raging fire was reported at the South Central Bell Central office, which is the phone exchange for the Saudi Daisy community. It says that the building was totally lost and it affected more than 5,000 people's service at the time. I think back then you still had to be connected from an operator and it still had to go through the phone switch.
Probably, yeah.
So that's part of the reason that it impacted people's service. I think it was actually the hub to where that's what they did. And it was the biggest loss they had ever had. So less than 15 minutes after the fire started, 4 men disguised by Halloween masks and armed stormed through the entrance of the Red Food Store at 9358 Dayton Pike.
Now, Red's Food Store was what it was before it was Bilo, right?
Yeah. And now It's Food City.
And now it's Food City. Yeah.
They roughed up the manager and they stole the contents of the store's safe and their four cash drawers. One of the employees thought the robbery was a prank and barely escaped serious injury when he attempted to unmask one of the robbers. Yes, he thought it was a joke.
He was like, haha, very funny, guys.
Oh, my God. And the group got away. And 3 hours later, they found their car burning behind a church on the south end of town. And pretty quickly, they were like, it took Red Food a long time to be able to call the police because the there fire. Was no phone. And it took a while for even the fire department.
Why did they get out of there?
It just has a bundle of cash. It never, like, exactly says how much money they took from there. And it even took the fire department like a little bit. That's part of the reason that the building was completely lost is nobody could call the fire department. So it took the fire department a little bit to get there too.
Yeah.
And pretty quickly they were like, the math is not mathing here. Like those two things are connected. And by April 18th, two men were arrested for these crimes. One of them was Larry Parker, and he's an ex-Chattanooga police officer. And the other man was Jackie Robinson, and he was a well-known felon. Keep both of these men in mind because they will come back around in the story. I am going to throw so many names at you during the story, but I'm going to try to keep reminding you who these people are.
Larry used to work for the Chattanooga Police Department when I was an officer. And Jackie Robinson, not the famous one, is a felon.
This guy's name is Jackie Renner Robinson. Jackie Renner Robinson.
J.R.R.
Yes, Jackie Robinson, not the famous one. So by spring of 1973, other clubs were starting to pop up in Chattanooga and other people are starting to be like, this is a very profitable industry. And it was a fad at the time, so it makes sense. So crowds at the Castaway Club and the Lion's Den were not doing too great. But Play Late Club's still going strong because it's two different clubs in one. A little bit of rock and roll, a little bit of country. So they're still doing good. Just a few miles down the road from Castaways, in the 5600 block of Brainerd Road, was the Light Fantastic. It was owned by Richard and Beryl Ross. The bar had been in operation for years as a restaurant, and it was known as the Dugout before. The original building was a horseshoe-shaped bar with bar chairs and booths around it, and later they added a larger room to the back for a dance floor, stage, and tables. And they brought in all kinds of local bands and a local man named James Rogers, who actually ended up going on to play at Dollywood. He used to do there every night during the week. And then on weekends, they would have these big bands come in. And on the night of April 19th, 1973, the Light Fantastic was firebombed and completely gutted.
Who was setting these fires?
Well, it didn't take long for them to point the finger at Billy.
Damn it, Billy. You were fun until you weren't.
Just a few nights later, the evening of April 30th, 1973, in North Chattanooga, two blocks from the Walnut Street Bridge, there was another nightclub known as Trade Winds, and it's later known as the Tiki Hut. Last call at Trade Winds was at 11:45, and 23-year-old Roland Hargis and his girlfriend Donna Dunaway were making their way out to the parking lot. As Donna went to the driver's side to unlock the door, and Roland was over on the passenger side, a shot rang out. Roland fell between the two cars, and Donna just lets out this blood-curdling scream. A man named James Corvin, who had been Roland's friend for about 5 years, came over trying to render aid to Roland, but it was too late. And there was no witnesses other than Donna, and she said she wasn't even completely sure where the shots came from.
No, she's not, like, looking for somebody to shoot him. Shit.
And the police get there really, really, really quickly, and they find a .30-30 caliber hunting rifle like a block away in the bushes. So one of the detectives, Terry Slaughter, immediately had suspicions of who it was, and he leaves to go question said person, right? The same night, Larry Parker,
used to be a cop,
the ex-cop from the Red Food robbery, and his friend William Carter were out searching for Roland. After driving around and checking clubs for hours on their final pass, they're like, hey, isn't that Roland walking out of Trades Winds? And right as Roland was walking up, just so happened to be while they were driving by. So they parked their car Larry Parker jumps out, goes and jumps in the bushes, and shoots Roland. But what does this have anything to do with our story about Billy Hole? Why am I even telling you about this murder? Right. It was a well-known rumor that Roland was having an affair with Gloria Jean. And mind you, when this happens, Gloria Jean and Billy are already divorced. 3 or 4 days before Roland's death, he had it like a friend that's a cousin situation. Okay. And he was telling him that he was over his head with some like real bad stuff and he was worried for his safety. By June of 1973, Billy was ready to start expanding again. And instead of doing it in Chattanooga, he did it in Knoxville. Now, his club attendance was already starting to wane. So why he thought expanding was the best idea for him, I don't understand. But he opened the Missing Link Alpha Alcoa Highway in Knoxville. He had a business partner by the name of, I'm just going to call him Lon. So Billy and Lon are in business together, and Billy actually has a little apartment at the club, and he was spending most of his weekends there, and he was probably spending a lot of those weekends with Miss Vonnie Barnes. Vonnie Barnes is a bartender that I'm not sure if he had hired her for Knoxville or if she originally worked in Chattanooga and then came to Knoxville with him, or if she worked in Knoxville then came to Chattanooga.
But she's around it.
But she ends up working at more than one club for Billy. I mean, off the bat, this spot wasn't doing great either. By January of 1974, they were already behind 3 months of rent, and they were getting sued.
Okay.
I mean, pretty much off the bat, it's not doing good. May 1974, he takes out a $400,000 insurance policy on his Chattanooga clubs. That burned to the ground 2 weeks later. The insurance company just held the payment, and Billy did not like that, but it took until January of the next year, and he sued them, but I can't find if he ever got the payment.
So we don't know what happened.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't find if he got the payment or not. It doesn't say it in that book. It just says that he sued them for the check, but I don't know that he ever got the check.
Okay.
But even if he did get the check, it wouldn't have really mattered. Because March 27th, 1975, federal agents knocked on his door with an arrest warrant for tax evasion and fraud. Paul Gray had just got arrested 2 days before for the same thing. So the IRS charged both Billy and Gloria Jean Hull. They were still married in the years, even though at this point they were divorced, they were married in the years that they're being investigated for. So they took Gloria Jean in also.
Okay.
And they charged them with underreporting their income in 68, 69, and 70. And they both pled guilty with stipulations in June of that year. So Billy's defense to all of this is that grandmother Katie, the bootlegger, has a ton of money. And according to Billy, she hid all of her money in the backyard in glass jars. And while she was on her deathbed, Grandma Katie told Billy to go dig up all the glass jars and get them. And he says there was like $40,000 to $50,000 in there, which is like $372,000 now.
Just a little bit of cash.
And according to him, he did not lie about the money he was making, but he had this glass jar money, and that's the money he was spending through these years.
Okay.
The IRS didn't believe the glass jar money story, but I do, because Katie was an old Southern bootlegger, so I do believe that she had money hidden in her backyard in glass jars. I absolutely do believe that's a fact.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to say no.
I'm pretty sure it was more than he said it was.
Yo, yeah.
But the IRS even said that's fine, because even if, like, you do have this glass jar money, you should have told us about it.
Yeah.
And they say technically since Katie died, that should have went to Katie's estate and been split up amongst everybody, that Billy had no just to go get it. And even though he did go get it, he should have reported it as...
I guess it depends on the context in which she was like, hey, go get this money.
They actually ended up concluding that if he had all this loose jar money, he didn't have a safety deposit box. But he did have a big, like, safe in his house. So they're like, okay, we can concede that, yes, you probably did have this glass jar money.
Right.
But even though you're telling us it took years and years to spend this money, it wouldn't have been a major factor to explain the increases in, like, your net worth.
Yeah, we do agree. This money, you're probably telling the truth on this.
Right.
But you're still underreporting what you're making.
Yeah.
So he was sentenced to 75 days in prison and 18 months probation. She was only sentenced to unsupervised probation for a year. Because they say that she didn't completely know what was going on.
Oh, okay.
So the author of the book I read said that it was actually worth noting that Billy's ventures into the nightclub business and the construction of the Tiki Palace started within weeks and months of Katie's death. Okay. But there was way more money than what Billy said there was. Like, there wasn't just $40,000 or $50,000 there. There was definitely more than that. He's bringing the price down a little bit. So Billy and Paul were convicted of the same crime, given the same sentence, to be served at the same jail in Sevier County. And just a few days after Billy gets there, he's pulled into the office and they're like, hey, we're going to give you new living quarters. Well, Paul Gray pulls up in a 24-foot Winnebago that he parks on the side of the jail and like hooks up power to it. And that's where Billy and Paul get to serve out their sentences.
What?
Living in this Winnebago together next to the jail.
Lord.
Because they're like considered celebrities. So they're given jobs as trustees. And the jobs of the trustees were to go clean up the busted moonshine stills. And anytime they did that, there was always newspapers there. Billy and Paul are in one of the pictures getting at like cleaning up this moonshine still. And this federal judge sees it and is, wait a damn minute. Those two need to be separated. They haul the Winnebago off from the jail and they put them in jail cells. But they only had 2 months left of their sentence. So at that point, like it didn't even matter. Or not 2 months, 2 weeks. So it really was over. They were like, all right, put us in jail cell for 2 weeks. It doesn't matter.
So
already showing that these guys can do whatever they want.
Absolutely whatever they want.
Shortly after being released, Billy was charged for the arson of the Light Fantastic Club. By October of 1975, he was also charged for the murder of Roland, but he immediately posted a bond. And he was free until April 13th, 1976. The exact crimes that he was on trial for, accessory beforehand, the face of murder in the first degree, and premeditated murder in the first degree. And on April 20th, he arrived to the Hamilton County Courthouse with his lawyer, Jerry Summers, and ex-wife but now girlfriend, Gloria Jean.
Hold on a fucking second. His ex-wife, but now they're dating?
And they live together.
Okay.
They have reconciled.
I hate it.
So the prosecution's case was that Billy was so enraged at Gloria Jean's affairs that he not only killed Roland, but he had actually put out a contract on a Chattanooga police officer named Jerry Mitchell for the same thing. And they explained that Billy had it out for Roland and had banned him and his friends from like all of his clubs. And they explained how Billy had sought out numerous hitmen to do the killing and how they had literally the confessions of Larry Parker and William Carter, who had both admitted that they took out the hit for $3,000 and other benefits. The defense decided that their strategy was going to say that Roland was a dope pusher. This next trial part consists of so many police officers from the Chattanooga Police Department.
Okay.
I told you earlier, I'm going to throw a lot of names at you, but I'm going to always try to remind you how
they fit back. In.
So, first, the prosecution called Danny Willman to the stand. And Danny was a narcotics detective in Chattanooga with Jerry Mitchell. They both worked part-time at Castaways as security, but they were both fired and banned whenever Billy found out that Jerry was having an affair with Gloria Jean. He is the one that testified that before Gloria Jean had become entangled with Jerry, she was having an affair with Roland.
Before she got into an entanglement.
Billy had came to Willman and asked if he could get a mugshot of Roland. And Danny was like, there's not a picture because he's never been arrested, right?
Yeah.
Just a few days later,
he gets a call from Joe McCullough to help him arrest Roland at a tavern on a drug charge. Not long after, Roland's mugshot appears in Billy's office on the wall. On cross-examination, Willman admitted that Billy told him that he wanted the picture to confirm that he was the man that was seen in Florida with his wife by a private investigator. Right. And Billy had also told Danny Willman that he was going to crush Jerry's head for the affair.
Oh, my. Gloria. Okay.
So this is already...
We're in deep here, boys.
Already off the bat. So the next witness to the stand is Detective Terry Slaughter. Terry was the one that was at Roland's scene of his death and already had an idea of who it could be and left the scene to go talk to them. He left the scene to go talk to Billy and ask where Billy was.
Right.
When he goes to Billy, Billy is in the office with Joe McCullough, the last guy just testified about is the one that came in and was like, hey, we got to go arrest Roland. So Terry looks at Billy and he's like, where have you been all night? And Billy says, I've been here all night, and smiles real big and looks at Joe and is like, isn't that right, Joe? So years after this, I ended up finding Terry was in the news again for corruption. So next, Donna Dunaway, Roland's date for the night, is on the on the stand. And she was saying how they had been banned from all Billy's clubs and how there was places that Roland, like, was actually scared to go because Billy had an army. He had a little posse of people, and Roland knew that Billy was pissed at him. So he knew that. And they had had a friend come up to Roland that night, and Roland told Roland something, and Roland's demeanor, like, changed. Like, for the rest of the night, you could tell he was worried about something. He was, like, scared about something. And what the defense did was really lean into the fact that Donna's father had had problems with Roland and he was the trigger man because he had been there that night. And Donna's, you know, no, they did at one point have issues at the beginning of this relationship. But you're right. He was there with us that night, but it was in a friendly capacity. I didn't see who did the shots, but it wasn't my dad. Roland's been scared. So the second day of trial, there was even more spectators. And that's because the first witness of the day was Larry Parker. That is the Chattanooga police officer, gunman in Roland's death, and he was in the Red Food robbery. Parker testified about how he and Wayne Carter had been out searching for Roland all that night, and they had saw them coming out of Trade Winds. And during his testimony, he also said that he did not feel that Roland deserved to be killed and that he tried to miss him when he took the shot. That is crazy he would say that because this man was a SWAT team member at one point.
Tried to miss him?
Mm-hmm. Tried to miss him. But he didn't, and he did, in fact, kill Roland that night. When he asked if he had been asked to kill Jerry, he responded that he didn't want to kill Jerry because they were close friends, Jerry Mitchell. And he actually took the contract to kill Roland in hopes that it would prevent Jerry from being killed. He said that he told Billy, and I quote, I told him I wasn't going to get Mr. Mitchell and he had better hope nobody did get Mr. Mitchell. So next on the stand is Wayne Carter, the person that was with Larry that night. Wayne corroborated everything Larry said about what had happened before the shooting, at the shooting, the night after, everything. He agreed. And he said that that night he had saw Billy at the Castaways Club and told him that was going on, you know, what had happened.
All the things and the stuff.
And Billy just smiled real big and said, that's good. Billy leaps up in court and starts screaming from his chair, he's the biggest liar.
Oh.
And so his, like, defense attorney pulls him down and he apologizes to the judge, says, I'm so sorry, judge. So Carter said that Billy paid him $3,000, which today is $20,214 for the killing. And he kept $1,000 and he gave $2,000 to Larry Parker because Larry Parker is actually the one that did it.
He also testified that first he had contacted Jackie Robinson.
There he is.
Larry Parker's accomplice from the Red Food robbery. And Jackie had agreed to do it. But then he was actually in jail at the time that they did it. He was in jail. He went with Larry instead. So Jackie Robinson was in jail at the time that Roland was killed for the kidnapping and murder of the Hixson dentist Robert Elliott. I have looked everywhere and cannot find any information on this. I have looked so many places.
Hixson dentist.
Yes. I found one newspaper article on it on newspapers.com. But it's about, like, the trial of it. Nothing about the case. Okay. Nothing. I've looked everywhere. So if anybody knows any information on that, please send it to me. Because it plays a really big part in this case. It's brought up multiple times. He was also in jail for a Georgia murder and a jail escape. So on cross-examination, Jerry Summers asked Wayne, Mr. Carter, a man by the name of Doyle Jones was shot to death at a local restaurant on the morning of December 5th, 1972. Were you involved in that slaying? To which Wayne Carter pleaded the fifth and refused to answer any questions. That's another case I've looked for. I cannot find any information. Summers went on to ask Carter about the murder of Herschel Reese, which he denied. Herschel Reese murder is still to this day on the unsolved website on the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office. And I'm going to tell you about it.
And you're going to hear about it.
Investigators who worked the case say Reese's lakeside property was surrounded by a chain link fence topped with barbed wire. The killer or killers cut a section of the fence and then forced open a bedroom window. Detectives believe the killer then laid in wait inside the dark house for Reese to return from work the evening of Tuesday, December 5th. It's believed Reese left his restaurant at Hixson Pike at 11 o'clock that night and drove straight to his house on Grove Place near Sequoia Nuclear Plant. It appears the attack began in the living room. Reese had removed his shoes and was either seated or lying on a divan. Investigators found blood on the living room floor and Reese's fully loaded sawed-off double-barrel shotgun. A large diamond ring Reese usually wore was found under the cushion. Investigators suspect Reese hid it there before it could be taken from him. Reese's yellow 1971 Volkswagen Super Beetle was apparently used as a getaway car, and it was later found on Sequoia Road in Hixson Pike. The witness told sheriff's deputies that a young hippie man with long hair was seen leaving the car and hitchhiking along Hixson Pike. So, if anyone has any information about a person that matches this description or on Herschel Reese's murder, you can contact the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office at 423-622-0022 or the criminal investigation at 423-209-8940. So Carter also testified that Billy had told him a story one time that he had saw Roland off of Highway 153 and he had chased him up the embankment firing shots at him.
Okay.
So next to the stand was Donnie McKeel, another Chattanooga policeman, and he actually worked at the Castaways Club before he ever even was a policeman. And Donnie said that Billy had come to him asking him to hire a hitman because Billy asked everybody and their mother. And Donnie contacted a man named Jesse James Edwards to do the hit. And Jesse James Edwards said he'd do it for $5,000. He says that Billy and Jesse James had a meeting one time, but he wasn't there, so he doesn't know anything about it.
Okay.
But he does know that after Roland was killed, Billy came to him and said, one down, one to go, insinuating that Jerry Mitchell was next. So next we have...
I'm getting a lot of he said, she said with this.
Yes, but it sounds like Billy really did probably say it all.
There's that.
So John Thompson Jr. is next, and he's a former Chattanooga policeman that was fired from the police department and then got hired by the fire department. And he had also worked at Castaways.
Billy had also asked him to kill Roland for $3,000.
Okay.
But he just, like, never answered him and left him hanging. And he says that he reported this to his sergeant, but his sergeant says that he didn't report it to him. Jerry Summers also asked Thompson if he had any involvement with the murders of Herschel Reese or Doyle Jones, but he denied it. So by day three, filled to capacity. And the first person that Jerry Summers brought onto the witness stand was James Corvin. He was Roland's friend that tried to help him. Now, Corvin is saying that he saw the gun blast come from Clint Dunaway's car, which would be Donna's daddy. And he claimed that when he was running across to help Roland, Clint tried to hit him with his car. But the prosecution was like, why did you not say that to the police? And he just said, oh, I was scared. I didn't want to end up dead too. So then next, the defense calls a couple cellmates of Wayne Carter, basically just trying to trash his credibility.
Right.
And the next witness on the stand is Miss Vonnie Barnes. She's the one that worked at the Missing Link, the Knoxville Club, and then she had also been a bartender at the Castaways. It was reported maybe she had had an affair with Billy, but she would never admit to that. What she did say is that she used to date Roland, and that one day on 153, Highway 153, Clint Dunaway pulls up and starts shooting at him. That's completely opposite of what Carter said that Billy told him. So it sounds like they're trying to set Clint up to be the shooter of Roland, too. But she testifies that she was crazy about Donnie McKeel and that Donnie McKeel actually sold drugs while working at Billy's club before he ever even became a police officer. And, you know, when they asked her about the affair with Billy, she would never admit to it. She would only say she had a professional relationship with him. Mm-hmm. The last person on the stand was Miss Gloria Jean herself. And she didn't really give any good information. She just said that even though they were going through hard times and, you know, eventually a divorce, Billy never said he wanted to kill anyone. But
oh, we didn't.
Jerry Mitchell did try to convince her to poison Billy's drink one night. Now she says that they had actually reconciled and they were living together again. So by day four, Mr. Billy took the stand. And Billy testified that in early 1972, he had contacted Jerry Mitchell and Roland for a statement admitting they had both had an affair with Gloria Jean, which he did obtain, and which were both admitted into evidence. I assume that this was for their divorce court, to use that against her. That's a weird thing that someone would even do, so I don't understand. But he had these two statements. And he said that, yeah, he probably had threatened them out of anger over the whole affair situation.
Oh, probably.
But he would never do that. He would never actually hurt them. The prosecution's like, oh, okay, well, what about whenever you threatened Donnie McKeel yesterday in the hallway? The defense objected. Billy Hull was done for the day. So the first rebuttal witness the prosecution called was Clint Dunaway. And Clint says that he had been hanging out with Don and Roland that night. He had had a drink with them. They had had problems in the past. They did not have problems then. He did not shoot him. He did not try to hit anyone with his car. That would not, he had nothing to do with that. So the next two people are on the stand are Michael and Steven, Roland's brothers. And they are both saying that James Corvin told them he was smoking weed in his car and didn't see anything. So they're saying James is just now coming up with this. This is new. He's never said this before. So it was 6 o'clock that night. Jury went into deliberations and it took them 23 hours to come to a verdict. Since he had not pulled the trigger, he was found guilty only in accessory before the fact in the murder charge.
Oh, wow.
And at that time, the jury could actually determine the sentence that day. So he was given 20 years and one day imprisonment. Then his bond was doubled to $50,000. The same day, Larry Parker was also given 20 years and one day, and he was fired from Chattanooga Police Department because he had a burglary charge before Roland's murder, but he was still rehired as an undercover drug agent, even though those charges were pending against him. Those charges were possession of dynamite and conspiracy. I don't know. That's the only, like, explosive charge I see for anything. But you got to think they were bombing all these clubs and stuff. He's the one that robbed Red Food also. So.
Just fast and loose with the explosives in the 70s and 80s, my guy.
Very
fast
much. And loose. So at the time of sentencing, he also had a warrant involving the kidnap and the murder of the Hickson dentist. Plus, he was also charged in the killing of Barry Dale Godfrey, who was gunned down in front of his family. And he was indirectly involved with a bank robbery in Stevenson, Alabama. And accused of posing as a professional killer, he rolled two hand grenades down the aisle of an Alabama courtroom to kill one of the robbery suspects. William Carter was sentenced to 5 years because he was just an accomplice. He didn't pull the trigger. April 1976, 4 Chattanooga policemen and 1 fireman were suspended from their jobs because of this case. It was Joe McCullough and Danny Willman. They were both detectives. Donnie McKeel and Jerry Mitchell, who were both patrolmen. Mm-hmm. And then John Thompson Jr. was fired from the fire department. 6 days after the ending of Billy's trial, Larry Parker and William Carter were both sentenced to 10-year prison terms for the June 1973 larceny for more than $100,000 from the Hamilton National Bank of Saudi Daisy.
Are you kidding?
They testified for the prosecution, and they implicated a former bank manager named Robert Holland, Thomas McCauley, and John Shropshire? During the trial, both Parker and Carter testified they performed the larceny as the three men acted as a go-between. And Parker also received a 10-year sentence for charges of drugs for resale, arson, and possession of weapons. 18 days after the trial, on May 13th, Donnie McKeel was arrested by the Red Bank police on a charge of assault, because he showed up at Bonnie's house asking why she had testified against him, and he began beating her and threatening to rape her. It was only when her sister-in-law came outside with a shotgun that he fled the scene. And the Sunday before this, Bonnie had called the police to report someone had fired shots into her parents' house.
What the fuck?
So on July 30th...
So essentially, these guys just are not going to stop.
No. So on July 30th, a hearing was held regarding a request by Billy to have his friend Sam Jones post his bond. Mm-hmm. Sam Jones was a 61-year-old Signal Mountain man who was convicted in the 1972 beating death of a man who did yard work for him. The whole trial was a mess. Billy was yelling at the judge. The judge was yelling at Billy. The DA was yelling. It was an absolute shit show. So needless to say, they ended up putting it off for a different day for a different chancellor later on, a few weeks later. So the battle over the later hearing lasted like a week, and Billy did finally actually get bonded out. But then in August, Billy was already back in the news because he was making allegations against the district attorney's office and the police department for corruption. He was also making allegations against Joe McCullough, the person who had falsely arrested Roland.
Right.
And an investigation was actually opened and ran by the District Attorney General William Pope of Pikeville. But the result was basically that, yeah, Billy didn't get in any trouble because he paid people to lie, but those people chose to lie.
Okay.
And
I mean, you're not wrong, but
they weren't lying to the TBI, so it technically wasn't something that he could get in trouble for what I from what
wow.
I saw. And really all that came about was that Billy had paid Joe to fabricate the charges against right. Roland. So by winter of 1976, Billy actually opened a modest little health spa in a shopping center off of Highway 58 because he had some experience doing that. If you remember, that's what was paying his bills in the beginning. Yeah. So by November of 1977, court was in session for him in the conspiracy to commit arson in the light fantastic arson. But he was actually found not guilty on that one. But then his appeal on the murder charge was denied and he was sent back to jail. So at the same time, he's going back to jail. There's a whole nother political scandal that was kind of erupting in Tennessee at the time. Ray Blanton was elected the governor in 1975. And him and his staff were investigated at the same time all this stuff is going on for crimes involving state contract bid rigging, liquor license manipulations, and pay for pardon schemes. Which means basically people would pay him and he would get their loved ones out of jail.
Okay.
Bob Browntree was a gambler and club owner. Now the primary payoff man, Tommy Prater, the owner of the first strip club in Chattanooga, Classic Cat. And then Samuel Pettyjohn, a liquor store and nightclub owner in Chattanooga, was also involved. And we actually covered Pettyjohn's death in episode 13, Solve Cold Cases. Samuel Pettyjohn was a Chattanooga businessman in 1974 that owned a number of nightclubs that ended up burning for insurance money. And it was actually after he died that they figured out that he was the one that had burned his clubs for the money.
Okay.
So in 1976, Bob Browntree would raise money and pay the money to Governor Blanton's office, and they would release prisoners. Pettyjohn ends up going and working with the police during all of this. And he was killed execution style inside the Beverage Center located on Market Street in Chattanooga. Hours before his execution, he had told individuals that he needed to discuss important business with them after they were closed. At the time of his murder, they pretty much couldn't ever figure it out because nothing was taken. It actually ended up coming out that a man who died in prison in 2005 named William Edward Alley, a convicted bank robber, was tied to all this. Now, you can't tell me that Pettyjohn and all, I mean, bank robbers, bombings, all this, they have to be tied in with the other characters of our stories, too.
Right.
There's just too much shady stuff going on there.
There's no way. Like,
right, like it all has to be connected. By the time Blanton left office, he had 56 names in consideration for clemency. Was one of them Billy Hull?
No.
13 of those have been paid for, and in his 4 years in office, he had released 49 felons and 23 murderers. So, James Corvin, in April 1979, was found in the trunk of his girlfriend's car in a parking lot in a hospital in Chattanooga, Tennessee. The autopsy on the badly decomposed body concluded that the body's condition was impossible to determine the cause of death, which noted that the victim was wearing an imitation leather jacket with a bullet hole, powder burns, and blood stains. A .22 caliber bullet was recovered from the body. The victim's girlfriend testified that he left their house in Hickson, and he was driving her car, and he was going to meet somebody that was never... He never told her. It wasn't until 1998 when James Stephen Turner's wife testified that he was the one that had shot James and had left him in the hospital parking lot. So that's what happened to James. November 11th, 1984, Billy was paroled, and 1 year later, he was a completely free man. He only served 8 years and 5 months of his 20-year sentence. He went on to live in Key West, Florida, marrying a medical doctor, and he drove a truck for Key West, spraying for the mosquitoes. But he died of a stroke sometime around 1997, and he was 64 years old. As of the March 2023 release of the book I read, Gloria Jean is still alive and well. Paul Gray Jr. continued to gain wealth and opened a successful recording studio, actually, that was a jumping-off point for a lot of like young artists.
Oh.
And he was in the process of opening a new country club, club that plays country, country not music. Like, yeah.
Called, not a country club, but a country music club.
Yes. Called the Urban Cowboy. And oddly enough, Billy Hull Jr. worked as a bouncer for him at the Playlight and the Urban Cowboy, Billy's son. Paul built a new home on the mountain between Hickson and Soddy Daisy, and he really was good about donating to local charities. He never got in trouble again. He married multiple times through the years, divorced multiple times, and he fathered multiple children. On the evening of February 3rd, 1989, Paul approached his ex-wife's house at the Valley Brook subdivision in Hickson, and he and his ex-wife had a
custody schedule, and she hadn't let him see the girls for 3 weeks. He grabbed a gun from his car, and her husband ran and grabbed his gun. The two began having a gun battle. The new husband was shot in the chest, but lived. Paul Gray died on scene at the age of 55.
Oh, shit.
The Tiki Mansion was reportedly bought by Gloria Jean and Paul Gray after Billy went to prison, and it was sold to the Haggard family in the late 1970s. After several more owners, the house was condemned and seized by the city and was torn down in 2017, but it's now featured on countless abandoned websites. It's everywhere. I knew about this before I knew about the case. And Jerry Summers is still living and practicing law in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Wow.
And that's the case of the Chattanooga Club murders.
That's a doozy.
Yeah. I know a lot of y'all have to be like, what? There were so many names in this one.
What?
I tried to go back and remind you all who was who and all that. But yeah, no, that's what was popping off in Chattanooga in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Wild times, y'all.
Wild times. Hey, if you remember any of those clubs, let us know.
Holler at us.
Don't whistle in the woods at night.
Bye, y'all.